We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you build or deepen your meditation practice and keep your brain healthy, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. Don't forget to check out the hundreds of free meditations on Meditation Studio app. You can find these at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. Now on to our encore episode. Today's guest is Dr. Emeryn Mayer, a distinguished research professor in the Department of Medicine, Physiology, and Psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine. He's a world-renowned gastroenterologist and neuroscientist with 35 years of experience in the study of clinical and neurobiological aspects of how the digestive system and the nervous system interact in health and in disease. His bio and the awards he has won over the years are quite extensive. Today, we discuss his best-selling book, The Mind-Gut Connection, How the Hidden Conversation with Our Bodies Impacts Our Mood, Our Choices, and Our Overall Health. The book combines neuroscience and the latest discoveries on the human microbiome with lots of juicy insights on the biological link between the mind and the digestive system. He shares the science behind this communication pipeline and discusses how we can actually harness the power of this connection to take charge of our health and listen to the innate wisdom of our bodies. In other words, how to listen to our gut so we can learn to pay attention to the signals our body is giving us. A favorite quote of mine from this interview: the time has come for us to empower ourselves to be the engineers of our own internal ecosystem and our bodies and minds. This book goes into a lot more detail, so I highly recommend it if you are someone who's interested in the communication between the brain and the gut, or if you've ever had any type of gut challenge or disorder. You will find his work to be extremely fascinating. Now, here's Dr. Mayer. Dr. Mayer, it is really such a thrilled to have you on the show today. I'm a big fan of your book, The Mind-Gut Connection. So I'd love to start with this. You have been a pioneer in this research, and especially in the connection between the brain and the gut microbiome interactions. And I'm curious what originally inspired you to study this and to write this book to share all of this research and valuable information with others.
Yeah. So first of all, thanks, Patricia, for having me on the show. I'm always happy to talk about how this all came about. Sometimes I'm still amazed myself. It didn't come overnight. I have had a career-long interest in brain-gut interactions. In some ways, I could say this is even one of the reasons I went into medicine, because I was interested in brain-body interactions, and I picked the gut because it was the most obvious organ for me from the beginning where you can study this and where you can have a large number of patients experiencing symptoms. So we have done studies, research. I've seen thousands of patients over several decades. And most of the work was really focused on one clinical condition, the irritable bowel syndrome. This was the prototype for brain-gut interactions for a long time. And then about 10 or so years ago, the first studies from animals came out about the potential role of the gut microbiome in modulating brain-gut interactions, and particularly modulating brain function and structure and biochemistry. And I was very skeptical at the beginning because I thought the science that had accumulated over the last four decades about just brain-gut interactions was sufficient to explain certainly most of the clinical issues that come up in a typical practice. So we did one study, the first human study, really, where we looked at the effect of the ingestion of a probiotic cocktail over several weeks in healthy young women. And we found that this had an influence on structure and function of the brain. And that convinced me that it's worthwhile pursuing, got very excited, switched my research operation, our research center, fundamentally in two ways. One is we added stool collections for detailed microbiome analysis to all of our ongoing studies, which also have brain imaging in it. And my own interest spread beyond IBS and now got interested in a lot of other studies that are now considered potential brain-gut microbiome disorders, ranging from autism spectrum to cognitive decline to Parkinson's disease and a whole range of others. And that first study that I mentioned to you, where we've found an effect of the gut microbiome on the brain, that triggered a lot of interest in the lay media. And I got a lot of phone calls from publishers and agents. And it led ultimately to writing that first book, The Mind-Gut Connection. After a year, it kept increasing in sales and became a bestseller in gastroenterology, and has remained, believe it or not, over 6 years, the number one bestseller in gastroenterology on Amazon.
I'm not surprised that it's a number one in gastroenterology, because I think when people have stomach disorders and they can't be answered by traditional medicine, they're desperate for understanding what could possibly help them. And I would love for you to go over just the basics on what are microbiome or microbes, and how, if it's possible, to just simply explain how they influence the brain. What is the relationship between the brain, the digestive tract, and the trillions of bacteria in our gut?
The full story, we won't have time here to explain that. I could go on for a few hours. And anybody who's interested in the details should read The Mind-Gut Connection. But so microbes are the dominant life form on this planet and have been for millions of years. They occupy the planet's oceans, have lived there without competition for, as I said, millions of years, have developed a language to communicate with each other. So when the first animals in evolution appeared, there was an early realization for these microbes that when they live inside the gut of these primitive marine animals, that they would get a lot of benefits. They would get the benefits of safety, being protected, of being carried around for free. And they paid back the animal by providing important components that the animal itself could not produce. This was still all in the oceans. The symbiosis developed that it was good for the microbes to live inside the gut, and it was good for the host to have these microbes there that produced all kinds of substances that were beneficial for these marine animals. And that arrangement has stayed, believe it or not, for millions of years. We still have this today. In every animal on the planet, every animal has a gut microbiome. And microbiome refers to both the microbes, the organisms, and the functions that they exert in their gene pool. So microbiome means the players plus their functions. Microbes are just the players. So one interesting thing happened when the microbes were alone in the oceans. They developed a large number of molecules to communicate with each other and also to compete with each other, signaling molecules. So they accumulate a vast gene pool, millions of genes, many of which are related to this communication system. And then when they migrated into the gut of these first marine animals, there was a phenomenon called gene transfer, that some of the genes that they had were transferred to the gut of the animal they lived in and became the precursors of the neurotransmitters that animals have in their gut. That's another universal phenomenon. Almost every gut and any animal, any creature has its own nervous systems, the enteric nervous system. So nerve cells that are in charge of essentially peristalsis, movement, escape behaviors, secretion, blood flow regulation. So they are the regulatory system for the gut. And these genes that were transferred became the neurotransmitters for these nerve cells. And then fast forward in evolution, from this gut-based nervous system, ultimately, when the animals became unipolar, meaning having a head and a tail and a distal end, many of these neurotransmitter genes were transferred to the nerve cells in the head and became our main brain. So we have this almost continuous evolution over billions of years, from substances, chemicals that the microbes developed to communicate with each other, then communicate with the gut and the nervous system of these primitive marine animals. And then from there became the precursors of the neurotransmitters in our brain. So there's a common language that connects everything from the microbes all the way to our brain networks with which we think and feel and generate emotions. That's the story, really an amazing story, how evolution came up with a solution, which turned out to be very useful, and then maintained it and preserved it over a very long period of time of evolution.
So are you saying that the enteric nervous system, which is what you would also call the second brain, actually came first in animals?
Yes. So that term, the second brain, obviously was the name of a best-selling book by a friend and colleague, Mike Gershon. He didn't really write about this phenomenon, this evolutionary pathway. He wrote this book before the microbiome really came into focus and microbiome science started to become really popular. So he just called it the second brain because we all talk about our brain really being the first brain. But correctly, from an evolutionary standpoint, the enteric nervous system was the first brain, which was sufficient for this primitive marine animal that I mentioned a few times. It's called a hydra, tiny little thing. It's basically a floating digestive tract that has a beginning and an end. And this thing moves with its enteric nervous system, generates movement, but also generates peristalsis and moving food through its intestine. That animal didn't really need a standalone brain. They didn't need to think. It was all reflexive. So that enteric nervous system was sufficient for the functional needs for that animal. Only when, as I said, in evolution, animals evolved that had a head and had other functions to pursue, became it necessary then to have a central nervous system, with the enteric nervous system being like a partner, really.
I think you've referred to it somewhere in the book as the superhighway that goes between the gut and the brain. How do they communicate with one another? And the microorganisms that live in the gut, how does that influence that intercommunication?
Just looking back at my own research past, we learned over several decades, outstanding work by many investigators, that there were these communication channels between the gut and the brain, both in terms of nerve pathways, like the vagus nerve plays a big role in this, the sympathetic nervous system, hormones that are generated in the gut in specialized cells that either get into the bloodstream and reach the brain, or that act on nerve terminals in the gut and then are signaled by the vagus nerve. And also about immune cells. So we knew that about 70% of the immune system is located in the gut-associated immune system. So we knew this before the microbes came, that were these bidirectional communication pathways. The brain has very powerful mechanisms to send signals down to the gut via the sympathetic nervous system and the vagus. And that can, particularly the sympathetic, the balance between these two can adjust the gut or create a mirror image of our emotions at the gut level. So stress and negative emotions always have a mirror image at the gut level, and that's mediated by these nerve pathways that go from the brain to the gut. But then when the microbiome science exploded, we realized that these microbes produce hundreds of thousands of what's called metabolites. Many of them are neuroactive substances that can act either on the vagus nerve or get into the bloodstream and transfer to the brain, cross the blood-brain barrier. Some of these microbial metabolites could interact with the cells in the gut that store the hormones, these enterochromaffin and enteroendocrine cells, and could play a major role in the synthesis of hormones and neurotransmitters in these gut-based endocrine cells, which then would send out their content either into the bloodstream or to vagus nerve endings. And this realization made one thing clear. It was always a puzzle why, with the vagus nerve, only 10% go from the brain to the gut. Obviously, these 10% play a very important role in things like gastric acid production. And years ago, decades ago, cutting the vagus nerve was the main therapy for treating refractory peptic ulcer disease. But what we didn't know at the time, why are there these other 90% of vagal sensory fibers that go from the gut to the brain? Today, we know there's obviously a lot of information generated in the gut by these multiple specialized cells, immune, hormonal, immune cells, neural cells that provide an input to these signaling to the brain. But also we know that the microbes play a major role in providing signals that use these communication channels from the gut to the brain for their own communication.
And what happens when the communication is out of balance? And you also discuss how the gut influences emotions, pain sensitivities, social interactions, and even guides many of our decisions. And then the gut microbiota is linked to depression, chronic illness, neurological diseases, and mental health. So when we start bringing this very important science into our everyday lives, how does this happen? And then how do people become more aware of what they can do to improve this communication channel between the gut and the brain?
Yeah. So first of all, this communication system, it always used to be referred as the brain-gut axis, which means it's a simple linear pathway that goes from the gut to the brain. I've much preferred this term brain-gut microbiome system because it has multiple feedback loops and with both top-down and bottom-up signaling going on all the time. So this is not a linear system. It's as complex as the brain, which is also not a linear mechanism. So the mind-gut connection was written at a time where there was this explosion of new information and the excitement that this could explain diseases that we haven't really understood much better and don't have better treatments, like the psychiatric and neurological diseases. I think in the meantime, for many of these diseases that you mentioned, we have to be careful. So 90% of the studies, of the high quality studies that this concept of brain-gut microbiome diseases was based on animal models. And animal models are very powerful, and you can show many things, particularly causality between manipulating the microbes and then producing a disease-like behavior in this animal. So there's depression-like and anxiety-like, autism-like behaviors. How good they are as models of the human behavior is another question. But in any case, a lot of evidence has come from these animal models and continues to come from them. There's not a week that goes by, a recent study showed, that the motivation to exercise is influenced by gut microbiota in animals, again, in animal models. To show the translational relevance of that in humans is very, very difficult. These are not monogenetic, identical individuals like the mice are. We cannot control all the conditions, which you can do in a mouse facility, from dark light cycle, temperature, amount of food, what kind of food. And that's a big one, what food these mice are allowed to eat. So we can't do this in humans. And therefore, the human studies are mainly these association studies or epidemiological studies where people have compared one population or the microbiome in one disease population with another population that doesn't have that disease. And for all these diseases that you mentioned, Parkinson's, autism spectrum, cognitive decline, also depression, anxiety, these epidemiological cross-sectional studies have provided evidence that the microbes, and to a certain degree the functions of the microbes, is different from healthy control subjects. But none of these studies really has shown causality, that these microbiome changes really play a role in these diseases. One could easily say for many of them that the microbiome changes were a consequence of the disease. And depression, for example, anxiety, they're always associated with increased stress responsiveness, which we know well will influence the microbes. So we don't know what the chicken and the egg is. One way to get over this was people have taken stool samples from patient population and put them into mice without their own microbiome, so-called germ-free or notobiotic mice. And then they found when they transferred this patient stool with the microbes into the mice developed these depression-like or anxiety-like or autism-like behaviors. So we have some causality from these human to mouse studies, but not within humans. At some point, this will happen, but it's obviously a difficult challenge.
That's really interesting that it's the chicken and the egg thing. So your hypothesis is about the connection between the mind and the gut, but you can't be sure which is influencing which. Is that correct?
Yeah, and you could say in a different way, we assume that both the chicken and the egg is valid. For example, if you have patients that have a genetic predisposition and have adverse early life events and tend to have a higher likelihood of have some psychopathology, anxiety, depression, or that patients like that, when they have a dietary pattern like the standard American diet, also referred to as SAD, that dietary pattern contributes to the overall disease picture, that it most likely makes it worse through inflammatory influences, diet-induced inflammatory influences of the microbiome that then affects the brain further. So I'm convinced that that happens. So you establish this circular system. I still believe, because there's so much data that has accumulated over decades in terms of neuroscience of affective disorders like depression and anxiety, that in the majority of people, the problem starts in the brain. And that then affects the gut function, the gut microbes. Then comes the diet in and the lifestyle. We have had dramatic changes in our lifestyle the last 75 years in terms of moving to a completely sedentary lifestyle, eating an extremely unhealthy diet, being continuously stressed, chronically stressed. So all of these things feed into this brain-gut microbiome system. And that system adapts to be the best match to this new environment. And unless we work on all these angles and all these influences, I don't think just only changing your diet, if you suffer from a major depressive disorder, if you don't pay attention to psychological component, the exercise component, the dietary component, you will not be able to cure or effectively treat this with what's called a psychobiotic, like a probiotic that has been shown in animals to have an effect on emotion.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, over to Untangle. We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try.
They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping, available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Emotional behavior.
So let's say a patient comes to you and they seem pretty free of depression or anxiety, and you can't really detect any brain disorders when you see them, but they have terrible gut pain. And maybe they have IBS, maybe they have, let's rule out celiac because we know certain things are triggered by foods. What's your first course of action or discussion with the patient?
Well, there's always the initial assessment of their dietary habits, of their physical exercise, of their stress level, and their GI symptoms, obviously. And based on that, most of my patients present primarily with gastrointestinal symptoms, rule out celiac disease, obviously, rule out inflammatory bowel disease. And most of the patients that come to me, that's already been done. So I start a multidisciplinary approach. I address the mind with stress reduction techniques or mindfulness-based training, simple breathing techniques. So that's one component. Second component is to give them a roadmap for a healthy diet. And in general, I'm deviating somewhat from any of my GI colleagues. I personally believe that a largely plant-based diet, not exclusively plant-based, but largely plant-based diet is the best diet for your gut microbiome and for your gut. So we'll help patients to adapt this kind of a diet. We recommend that the daily regular exercise, and sometimes there's need for a medication. So if that patient suffers also from depression or anxiety, I will try an SSRI, which sometimes helps. If you reduce the psychological symptoms, then the gut symptoms get better. These drugs don't help the gut symptoms per se directly. And I would say education, making the patient aware. So writing my books has helped a lot, because now I would say 90% of my patients come with the book into the clinic and say, I'm patient so-and-so in your book, what should I do? And this has become the major goal of myself, to help promote this on the internet with educational activities, all the things we do in newsletter and social media, and working on a masterclass, working on a documentary for PBS. So that's step one. I think people have to realize these are not insurmountable problems, these gut symptoms. I would say once you have the right framework, they're actually fairly simple to deal with. There may be an exception of maybe 1% to 5% of patients that come with these symptoms that I often feel in the beginning, and I tell the patients, I'm not able to help you. This is way too complex and with some behaviors ingrained and belief systems ingrained. And if you cannot subscribe to the model that I propose, I won't be able to help you. But that's a small minority.
And that makes sense, too. You have a quote in your book, "The time has come for us to empower ourselves to become the engineers of our own internal ecosystem and our bodies and minds." And it sounds to me like that's really what you're saying, that we need to, and you collaborate with your patients to look at their health holistically, which is so different from what's done in our current healthcare system, which has more of a disease model. And do you feel like the healthcare system is moving in your direction or not so much?
That's an interesting question, because I think what has happened, because the medical system has been so focused on the disease care model, that another specialty has sprung up, functional medicine, which has a holistic viewpoint on diseases, emphasizing lifestyle as a major thing. Unfortunately, probably for financial reasons, that functional medicine community relies heavily on the sale of supplements, which I'm much more skeptical and much limited in terms of what I would recommend. But they have developed a system where they spend an hour with a patient. Patients love it. So I think there are positive things happening. The problem is, in order to make the salaries that attracts young physicians into gastroenterology, into their specialty, you have to follow this model, 15 minutes per new patient, followed by a procedure. And that just doesn't allow you to really take care of that patient. And that's Well, I think these internet-based and social media-based approaches and this empowerment of the patient are better because you can spend a lot more time with the patient answering questions. And I don't know, there's positive signs and there's remaining obstacles that are driven partially by the economics of medicine.
Yeah, it's complicated, right?
Yeah.
Back to, you were talking about functional medicine doctors tend to recommend a lot of supplements, and I have seen this myself. You said that's not your style, but for people that come in to see you, are there some must-have supplements that you recommend, like an omega-3, or what is the best supplement across the board to keep our microbiome healthy?
I'm not bad-mouthing or rejecting all the supplements. And my patients come from a fairly affluent portion of Southern California, from the west side of Los Angeles. So they have the financial means and the access to all the healthy foods that I recommend. It's largely plant-based diet from Whole Foods and Trader Joe's. And there's studies that have shown that, for example, there was a study with a polyphenol, flavanol, very large study that showed patients benefited the most who were on poor diets that did not contain enough for these flavanol-containing fruits and vegetables. So my feeling is if you are fortunate to have access and are educated enough to buy the real thing, you won't benefit from these supplements. It's more like a placebo. There's another consideration. Most of these supplements are not, even though it's always claimed, the effectiveness over placebo is not supported by high-quality studies that you would require for a medical treatment. But there's a few exceptions. There was a big, called the COSMOS study, on tens of thousands of patients that was recently finished with a flavanol supplement, which showed decrease in cardiovascular mortality and improvement or slowing of cognitive decline. That's the kind of thing that I would recommend. And I actually take it myself. There's a few of these around now. But at least you have that amazing evidence from the omega-3s have also fairly strong data, even though if you do a meta-analysis, often it shows that it's not that clear-cut, the benefit. But I think we know enough about the importance of omega-3 fatty acids on, for example, hippocampal function and neurogenesis, that I would also consider this one of the something that I would endorse and take myself. If I'm willing to take one of these myself, then I will also endorse it.
That's what I was wondering. So is that what you take, flavanol and omega-3s?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to shift for a second because you have some chapters on emotions and gut feeling. And I wanted you to share, and you talk about intuitive decision-making versus rational and logical decision-making. How do you define intuition from your science perspective? And just simply gut feeling? And is intuition the same as a gut feeling? And what's happening here between the gut and the brain?
This is a difficult subject. Sometimes I thought it'd be worthwhile writing a whole book on this, because in a book, I presented this in a careful way, that intuitive decision-making is taking advantage of a vast database of experiences that are stored within your nervous system that you have made and where you felt good or bad. And that you can access this database just like doing a Google search, that within milliseconds, you find the right answer. And this will come up more even now. People talk a lot about recently about artificial intelligence and how it's now rapidly becoming available for a lot of tasks and putting people out of business. It is some artificial intelligence that is based on a database of millions of bits of information that we have accumulated. And it's not based on the rational decision-making. You have learned things from your parents and in school. And when you make a rational decision, it's based on these plus-minus lists, what's good and what's bad. And then ultimately, you see, did again, the positives outweigh the negatives, and that's then your decision. But that's a lengthy, it's a slow process. It's often very good for you and successful. But there are examples. I mentioned this example in my book of this false alarm of incoming nuclear missiles on the Russian radar screens, and that this guy who was in charge of that facility, who saw that, but he made this gut-based decision, which he said with his own words, that this can't be true, that the U.S. is sending these missiles.
Oh, right. I remember this.
And he did not ring the alarm bells and trigger a massive counter response to this, which would have been World War III. So this is like within seconds, this man had to make that decision. So how did he make it? It was not that he went through, well, it could be this, but it's unlikely. And so the brain has this ability, and I postulated that it has a lot to do with these signals. Like every time you have a good or bad experience, there's always a component of your gut involved in this. And from the gut, and possibly your microbes, that generate a signal back to the brain, and that's stored like an emotional video clip, I called it.
You called it like a little YouTube video.
I have seen pictures of that in art exhibitions where people created an image with 10,000 tiny video screens in it. And each of these video screens, somebody was saying something. That's the image that I suggested, that how the system could work. The problem is this intuitive decision making, often it's life-saving. Many times it's the right decision. If I look at my own life, most of the time I would say when I made these gut-based decisions, they were the right thing for me, very personal. If I had made a different decision, it would have been influenced by what my parents wanted to do or what a mentor told me. And often I went against those inputs or those suggestions and stuck with my own gut-based decision. Most of the time it was correct. But I also mentioned this, that if you're an anxiety-prone person, and that could be based on genetics and these early life experiences, then you have a bias to always overestimate the negative impact of something, and something that's called catastrophizing in psychology, that you assume the highest likelihood of the worst possible outcome. If your mind works like that, then your gut feelings are probably not always provide the best information for you, because you will avoidance will be a major thing that comes out of this. And you would have to first work on your system. It's easier said than done, that you don't have that strong negative bias, which you can do in cognitive behavioral therapy. But for a lot of people who don't have that, I would still think it's an amazing ability that our organism has to make some of the most important decisions. Falling in love with the right person, marrying the right person, of the hundreds of thousands of options that you have, is one of these. For if you follow your gut feelings rather than appearance or something else or money, it's likely to be the best decision that you make. And same with your profession. If you make it simply based on the projected income or the status you get from it, as opposed to what is really your personal decision on that? What do you like? What gets excited? Anyway, so it's a difficult topic, and some very intelligent people have written about it, written books about it. I can't prove that this brain-gut microbiome system plays a role in it, but it's a plausible explanation.
It's very complex. Before we close, I just want to ask you about your own lifestyle. And I'm curious, what is your diet, exercise, meditation? How do you take care of yourself and your microbiome?
So that has evolved over time. I pride myself to have followed this intuitive decision-making course throughout my life. So that's one thing as a background. And I feel very pleased today that I am where I am, because that is me and that's always been me. And I've got different reincarnations of that. So that's good. So what do I do? It's changed over time. So I grew up in southern Germany, in the foothills of the Alps. Physical exercise was a major lifestyle. So hiking, climbing mountains almost every weekend, skiing every weekend in wintertime. So that was a big thing. And to maintain that, a lot of physical exercise, going to the gym twice a week for 2 hours. So that was the part, not paying attention much to my diet. Writing the first book, The Mind-Gut Connection, diet came in as a major factor that I never really paid attention to, other than what tastes good. And that has evolved over time. So we've developed what we think could be the optimal dietary regimen. So we try to prolong the time where our digestive system is empty. So this is called the 16-8 kind of dietary pattern, where you leave the gastrointestinal tract without food in it for a prolonged period of time, allowing your digestive system to cleanse itself. This is not that you put the GI tract at rest. It's actually quite active when it's empty, with these cleansing mechanisms that it has, these contractile waves and secretions. Then we developed something which we call a bowl. We don't call it breakfast bowl because we don't eat it until noon, which is pretty much a combination of seeds and nuts, fermented either yogurt or kefir. It's very rich in fiber and polyphenols, so berries. And this has evolved over time. I think the way we have it currently is you couldn't really surpass it in terms of the goodies for your microbes that you put in this. It's always focused on this concept. If you provide the optimal diet for your microbiome, you will also do the optimal thing for your own body and for your brain. And then our early evening meal is also half the week. It contains some fish, usually the small fish or the fish that are high in omega-3s and meet our environmental conservation requirements, and a lot of different vegetables, both with the fish, but also with the salad. So generally, when we count those, it's about 15 to 20 different plants and vegetables, fruits and plants that we eat during a day, because this diversity is a major thing that will force your gut microbiome to diversify and create the healthiest possible gut microbiome, decrease, minimize inflammation. And also weight-wise, it's something that even though you consume enough calories, it's not associated with weight gain, if anything, with coming to an optimal weight. Exercise-wise, I don't do it as extreme as I did it as a teenager back in the Alps, but we try to do a brisk, strenuous walk every evening, 4 to 5 miles up a close mountain / hill in our neighborhood, and also do workout muscle bearing resistance exercise for half an hour. And believe it or not, I mean, it's hard to fit all this into a 12-hour day. It's actually more than 12 hours. It's 20 minutes of meditation, which I have done on and off in my life, but definitely now it's become an essential part. We'll practice the same things I recommend to my patients. Deal with your mind, treat your gut and your gut microbiome optimally, and maintain your muscle function.
Wow, this is a lot of really amazing information. And is there anything else before we close that you'd like to share that we didn't touch on here that could be helpful?
Yeah, so one thing that I've realized, and I don't really have a good solution for it, what I promote and practice myself in our family, it's really for people that have the financial and time resources to do that. I've neglected targeting the people that would need this advice the most. It's people in the lower socioeconomic background disproportionately and who do all the wrong things in terms of diet and exercise and don't have time to meditate. It's difficult to reconcile this. I can do it today because I've come to a point in my career where I'm able to delegate a lot of the activities. Still work really hard in the evening. Never thought I would continue to work these hours, but I do have the time. If I really have the discipline, I do have the time to do it. I think a big goal should be to adapt these advices and these recommendations to people that need it the most. I haven't quite figured out how to do this. You would have to start in school. It would have to come probably from governmental regulation, but there's going to be a lot of resistance against that. Education alone would not be sufficient.
It sounds like you're doing a lot to move in that direction with documentary and potentially another book. You're educating people. And I do agree, there's so many of people I talk to that I think, oh, wow, if this could be translated to children at a young age and everyone could learn these things, it would be so amazing. So you are for sure moving in the right direction.
Yeah, and this is, for me, it's the most exciting part of my career now. I've written enough papers, so that's no longer a priority for me. The priority is to get this to as many people who need it the most, and we're working hard on that.
Well, I'm glad you're planting all those seeds. Dr. Meyer, thank you so much for being with us today. This has been so informative and really grateful for your time.
Well, thanks, Patricia, for the opportunity. I hope your listeners find this useful for their own lives. I'm glad we had this conversation.
Thanks so much for joining us today. You can find Emeryn's books at all major booksellers, and there's more information on his work at emerynmeyer.com. Check out the Muse Spring discount at choosemuse.com. Use promo code SPRING15. As always, questions or suggestions for guests, email me at untangle@choosemuse.com. I always appreciate your recommendations on guests and topics or themes for our podcast. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.